are listening to a free version of The Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Thursday, April 20th, 2017. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, author, writer, historian, founding editor of The Baffler, author of What's the Matter with Kansas and Listen Liberal, Thomas Frank will be here with us. Also on the program today, Jason Chaffetz, exiting, shipping off on Nauvoo. I don't know. Anybody got that reference? Forget it. Do Republicans have a new health care deal? Unlikely. Trump snubbed by the better Patriots. And the unbearable lightness of Andrew Cuomo. Also, have you seen our naval armada stationed in the Pacific? Meanwhile, pot legalization at an all-time high. Oh, it's 420. And Scotty B. heading to potty with Kiwi kings and queens and princes and princesses.
Trust me, dude. None of the girls in New Zealand look like Elizabeth Warren. Thank you, Mr. Trump.
And, of course, today is the first day of a future without Bill O'Reilly, ladies and gentlemen. Bill O'Reilly, we hardly knew you. Now, folks, in celebration, let's turn down the music here, Matt. In celebration for saying goodbye to Bill O'Reilly, we're going to play a clip from the opera Bill O'Reilly, or I should say Macris V. O'Reilly. This was a Baroque oratorio composed by Igor Keller. This uses the verbatim transcript of the sexual harassment complaint brought by Andrea Macris against Bill O'Reilly back in 2004 or 5 or 7. I can't remember what it was. I actually am looking at a CD of this opera because I believe Igor was a fan of the original Majority Report. This was actually performed. I'm not exactly sure where it was, but if you can't see this, then go to our YouTube channel to watch it because it's definitely worth it. But this is from one of the choice parts of the transcript. You'll recall that Mr. O'Reilly, according to the complaint, would masturbate while he was talking to his producer on the phone. Of course, that is a classic practice on shows like these. And but here is, but what's really awkward is the description of what he would be telling the producer he would be doing. And here it is, again, sung as a Baroque oratorio. I don't know what I'm talking about. Good.
And I would take that little loop and think you would be different in kind, so up your back. From it all over, you'll get you to relax. Hot water and a mendum and a mute, feel the tension drain out of you.
Yeah, the tension's really gonna drain out of here.
And a mendum, you would still be with your back to me, then I would find a it's one of those mitts, those lukumits, 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 lukumits. You'll know, so I got my hands in it.
I think that's the crescendo. You have really, 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 really spectacular boobs.
I don't say that to my wife anymore. She's a total bitch. Hey, family, honey, I'm home. No more shows. We can spend more quality time together. Welcome to the family dinner, Bill O'Reilly.
We will talk a little bit more about that later in
my
the program.
But apparently, liquid.
The payout was in the is going to be extraordinary, and I got to think that has as much to do with keeping quiet than anything else. I don't know that Bill O'Reilly really has. You know, he'll go somewhere else maybe if he didn't have the money. But I don't imagine it would be anywhere that is terribly competitive with Fox. You know, maybe they'd put him on WorldNet Daily or some type of internet show.
WorldNet Daily.
But I imagine there's a lot of things that he knows that they don't want them to talk about, so they just pay him off. But
is there no sound on YouTube?
All right, well... What happens when a med school graduate with $500,000 in student loan can't find a job and starts conducting free therapy sessions for patients he finds on Craigslist? There's only one way to find out. Watch the new series Shrink, featuring Tim Baltz and other top Chicago comedians. Chicago is where, you know, obviously Second City and a lot of the improv folks started out there. But also on CISO, you get unlimited access to Next Day Late Night. You get British cult comedy, binge-worthy classics, like all 42 seasons of Saturday Night Live, and the entire Monty Python catalog. CISO has tons of other great original series like Harmon Quest and Bajillion Dollar Properties, which is actually very funny. All on demand and commercial-free. You can see stand-up specials from Jenna Friedman. That's the one, actually, I wanted to see. She's very funny. She used to be a producer on... Daily Show.
Has she been on the show?
No.
Oh, okay.
That's actually, we should have her on. Or watch your favorite sets from comedians like Louis C.K., Amy Schumer, Hannibal Buress. You ready for the punchline?
Of course.
It's not even that funny. $3.99 per month.
Well, you know, speak for yourself.
I guess it's all in the delivery.
It is all in the delivery.
Just go to CISO, CEESO.com right now. Sign up for 2 weeks free. 2 weeks free, folks. Using the promo code MAJORITY at checkout. Check it out for free. CISO.com. That's spelled CEESO.com. Promo code MAJORITY. CISO.com. Promo code MAJORITY. 2 weeks free. And folks, April is just about to end. Well, not just about to end, but it's going to end eventually. So MR Spring 17, you get 30% off. You're Just Coffee. Go to justcoffee.coop. 30% off, free shipping. MR Spring 17. Do this now. It's a great way to try out Just Coffee or to buy your 5-pound bag so you can last the whole year. All right, going to take a quick break. When we come back, Thomas Frank. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program the founding editor of The Baffler, the author of the best-selling What's the Matter with Kansas, and his most recent is Listen, Liberal, Thomas Frank. Thomas, welcome to the program.
How are you today, Liberal?
I'm doing pretty good. You seem like you're in a pretty good mood.
Yeah, well, now that O'Reilly's gone, I'm allowed to say these things. You know, now I can be the O'Reilly. I'm thinking about making that move, you know.
What's that? Oh, yeah. I think you and I have actually speculated in the past how much more lucrative it would have been if we just had to Jesus moment.
I don't know if I could be as cranky as him, though. And he kept that up day after day after day, that veneer of crankiness.
I don't know if that was I think that was pretty organic. I think that ran pretty deep.
You think? Probably at some level. I was on his show a number of times way, way, way back when. His personality varied considerably from show to show. He also had a radio show back in the day.
That's right.
If I remember right.
And do you think, what do you think it made for those changes in personality? I have a feeling
it was a different medium. So I would be on his radio show and he was a completely different person.
Oh, really?
And then I'd be on his on his TV show and he was impossible to deal with. Yeah, he was actually friendly to me on his radio show. It was strange.
Do you think it had anything to do with maybe the time of day and perhaps exercises he had been doing with his arm, bringing things into his mouth?
Yes, I do. As a matter of fact, I think that's right.
Yeah, I think I think he would hit the bottle sometime after between the radio show and the TV show. all right, but let's and I've promised you off air to send you the clip that we just played from the opera Macris v. O'Reilly, which somehow you missed back in the day, but I will send that to you. But I do want to talk to you.
It really is the end of an era here. I mean, this is the man that, in some ways, brainwashed a generation. You know, that's going too far. Of course, I'm exaggerating, but he really set the tone for Fox News. Now he has so many imitators now. But, very influential. And this is stuff I've been writing about for years. I've sort of, I don't care about it anymore, don't follow it anymore. But once upon a time, I was absolutely engrossed with it.
Yeah, I mean, it's different now, though, because it seems to me what changed from the era, when he was in his heyday, right? It seems to me, which is not to say that his numbers weren't diminished, but the ability for right-wing media to inject a narrative into mainstream media seems to me to have diminished to some extent.
Yeah, that's right. But it's also that what he was doing and what he was selling was startling and kind of fresh when he started. Now, it wasn't fresh if you followed right-wing politics and thinking for a long time. And it's no coincidence that Roger Ailes, his boss, came out of the Nixon campaign, because this is all very similar to what Nixon was doing. But when O'Reilly was new, he had this kind of working class populist attitude to him that wasn't necessarily right wing. Do you remember this?
Yes.
And he was kind of an interesting thing, but it was the first time anybody had really tried something like that on national TV, and he was successful with it. And then, he later became that sort of cranky. I'm not saying that he was ever not conservative, but there were moments where he was actually kind of fun to watch for someone like me way back when. I shouldn't say anything nice about Bill O'Reilly, though. I don't, the guy I really can't stand,
Well, that's how we're going to title this this episode.
Nice things about O'Reilly.
Yes, Thomas Frank louds O'Reilly upon his exit.
I'm so sorry. Now I feel just disgusting. Ooh.
All right. Well,
yeah, that's one guy I swore I would never say nice things about. But
all right. Well, listen. I know that we have limited time, so I want to get into this with you. What's interesting that's going on now, as opposed to, let's say, even like 2 or 3 weeks ago, there seems to have been a resurgence of the sort of continual, and not that it's really ended, But just in the past couple of days, it seems to have become more pronounced again. The sort of relitigating of the Bernie versus Hillary battle within the Democratic Party. And I think there's a couple reasons for it, right? You know, the Clinton book just came out. Also,
it's a book about the Clinton campaign.
A book about
right? I haven't read it yet, but it's not a book by Hillary Clinton.
No, no, it's a book about.
She's written many books, but
no, this one is recently. A sort of a tell-all. And but it also we also have like the juxtaposition between what just happened in Kansas and what just happened in Georgia in terms of these special elections and the difference in these their approaches. And we also, I mean, another element of this is you've got. People promoting a guy, Heath Mello, who is running for mayor in Nebraska, in Omaha, I think it is, and who, you know, was a sort of a vaginal ultrasound guy. I mean, so...
What?
Yeah. I mean, this is...
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, he was someone who I think promoted, my understanding is was, you know, prior to abortions... That women should have to have ultrasounds.
I'm familiar with that, with the cult of the ultrasound, but he's a Democrat?
Well, that's the thing. This is part of the battle that is going on here. I mean, that there are feelings that, and, you know, this is someone who I think, you know, there's getting a lot of push to get elected by the sort of Bernie-crats on some level, and broadly speaking, but I don't know how many people knew what was in Heath Mello's full repertoire of positions, and of course this is in Nebraska. But, I mean, I just want to get your sense of where we're at in terms of the resistance and this fight to reform or not reform the Democratic Party.
To reform the Democratic Party, well, so, by the way, I just got back from a 13-city book tour. Last time, well, I mean, now 14 cities. I was just in Seattle. When was the last time we spoke? Was it before I started on the tour?
I think you were. I think we spoke on Ring of Fire when you were like sort of in the middle of the tour.
Yeah, yeah, and I noticed a lot of obviously the kind of people that want to hear what I'm saying tend to be the Bernie Sanders supporters, and so I was. There's a lot of Bernie Sanders support out there still. A lot of people really like this guy. I was kind of surprised by that. But I was also surprised by the few sort of run-ins I had with your kind of NPR culture, you know, the sort of foundation, TED Talk liberalism. And they really still are, you know, contemptuous of Bernie Sanders. I was amazed by that and brought it up out of the blue. You know, I guess not knowing that I was the guy that had written that story in Harper's Magazine about, you know, Sanders and his the Washington Post's war on him and that sort of thing, that I knew a great deal about this subject. There's still I was surprised to discover that there is still this real contempt for Sanders among a certain kind of Democrat. I was watching one of the Sunday talk shows the other day, and Sanders' name came up. And the scorn for him, and this is not, by the way, not among politicians, journalists,
yes.
Mainstream D.C.-style journalists, you know, remember, like the people I wrote about in Harper's Magazine, you know, that story about Sanders in Harper's, they hate the guy. Or they laugh at him, you know. They think he's a joke. And still, you know, today, when he is the most popular politician in America, this is surprising to me. But the war within the Democratic Party is going to take quite a long time to unfold, and I don't know if it's going to go in the direction that I want it to go in. Sam, I think there's a very good chance that the Clinton faction will retain its hold on the Democratic Party.
I mean, give me a sense of why you feel that way.
Because the contempt for Sanders is still so powerful out there.
Is it just contempt for Sanders, or is it contempt?
Well, I'm not talking about any of the sort of insider things. I mean, we all saw what happened to Keith Ellison,
right?
You know, when he But I don't have any, you know, you got to remember, I don't have any insider knowledge about the Democratic Party. I am not one of those people. You know, I just know what I read in the papers, same as everybody else, or what I read in Politico, I should say.
But I mean, what do you think, give me your analysis of it insofar as, is this a personal contempt, or is it how deeply ideological is it?
I don't think it's personal towards Sanders. He's a hard person to hate, you know. Right. I think it is towards, I think it's ideological, but it's complicated. Okay. The Clinton wing of the Democratic Party are the people that I described in Listen Liberal. These are, professional class liberals. They regard themselves as being experts, as being extremely pragmatic. They know how everything works in Washington, that sort of thing. And they look at a guy like Bernie Sanders, and you know, the sort of constant criticism of him that they still use, which is that, you know, none of his proposals are practical, that they wouldn't get anywhere in Congress, and they feel, you know, so on that level, they are realistic and he is not. And this is, by the way, ridiculous in 100 different ways, but it speaks to who these Democrats are, that's how they understand themselves, as the people who know how to get things done. You know, the experts. And then there's this other sense in which Sanders represents really the past of the Democratic Party. He represents a kind of past that these people have thought was done. They thought Bill Clinton finished it off back in the early 90s. You remember the Democratic Leadership Council. That was the whole idea, the new right. Democrats, the Third Way. They were breaking with the New Deal. You know, that kind of liberalism was dead and gone forever. And here comes Sanders, you know, advocating this stuff as though nothing has changed, you know, as though it's still the 1940s. And that really bothers this kind of Democrat that we're describing here. I think in a kind of psychological sense that he's able to do that, and that it's a return of the repressed sort of thing.
It's interesting to, you know, the first part of that that profile, I guess, the idea of like really pragmatic, the can do. I mean, I think that's what is in some respects most devastating about this book about the Clinton. And I've only, you know, I've read extended excerpts of the campaign was the just sort of the screw ups, right? I mean, not even screw ups, just like the overconfidence and the lack of doing sort of some of the more basic bunting, catching, fielding type hitting stuff.
Yeah, it was all big data, right? So yeah. I haven't read the book at all, but I mean, this is anybody can tell this. These were people who were the hubris. These were people that were supremely self-confident right up to the end. And they thought that big data could bring it home for them. Why did they think that? Because that's what everyone said about the 2012 election. That's what everyone said about the 2008 election. There is a real feeling among the kind of Democrats I'm describing that human beings are not persuadable. That, you know, you can't change anything about anyone, and that the only political game is the ground game. It's getting out your people, which you do via big data and with, you know, some fancy computer program. You remember all those stories about Obama's miraculous 2012 computer programs. Right. You know, that's what the race was supposedly about. That's how he beat Mitt Romney, was with this special software. Do you remember?
Yes.
Maybe you didn't read those books, but that was what the argument was, you know.
But the irony is that actually they did not use modeling nearly as much as the Clinton people did. I mean, my understanding
is that right? The Clinton people doubled down on this.
They doubled down on this.
Of course they did, right? Because she doesn't have the charisma that Obama – she doesn't have what Obama had.
But it's not even that. It's that – the modeling, they didn't even know. They were knocking on the wrong doors in states like Pennsylvania.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, and that ended up being the biggest problem, is that they were so confident in the modeling that they did not have people in the field where other campaigns had.
I would say the other thing that we always forget when we talk about these things is that you have to have a message also. And I mean, this is Hillary Clinton's like most obvious weak point. I mean, she's running as a resume candidate. She does not. She is not offering anything. You know, the whole idea of the Democratic Party is that people vote their demographics, and you don't have to offer them anything. And she didn't offer people anything. Now, Trump, I can't stand Trump, but one of the fascinating things about this election, and you know, I am so tired of this, Sam. All my life, I have been repeating the same arguments to the Democrats, and they just don't care. They just don't listen. But this man just showed that persuasion works.
Right. You know? Even if you're lying,
he's out there holding these rallies of 30,000 people. He's talking like Bill O'Reilly. You know, everything that we're describing here on this show, you know, in one man, and people think he's, you know, this great. They think he's this wonderful, charismatic leader. You know, but I guess only by comparison to Hillary. Anyhow, it's like, you know, I just was reading another article the other day by some, you know, Democratic leaning journalist, and they were arguing once again. I can't believe people are still saying this, but they were arguing one more time what the Democratic Leadership Council used to always insist, which was populism doesn't work. Oh, dude, populism doesn't work. We know that, you know. For they come up with whatever reasons that the Democratic Leadership Council used to give for why Democrats can't be populists anymore. And it's like, you just got your ass whipped by a populist, as you did with George W. Bush, and as you did with Ronald Reagan, and as you did with Newt Gingrich to a certain degree. Populists be kicking your ass all the time. And you need to figure this out. They can't. You know, it's all like, well, the modeling and the software, and we've got Eric Schmidt on our side.
Well, who's the they here? I mean, you know, we have now Tom Perez is going around on a tour with Bernie Sanders.
Yeah.
And Perez, obviously, from the sort of the Obama wing of the party, where I don't know, you know, where that fits into this spectrum necessarily, but also a guy, you know, he's going and he's they're doing a lot of like union talk right now.
This is Sanders stuff then.
Right.
That's what's going on. So they're trying to get the Bernie wing. You know, everybody can see that's the. After I just told you all this stuff about how the Clinton people are, still in the saddle, at the same time, they want what Bernie has. This man is the most popular politician in America. They want that. And they also, by the way, it's very interesting that they're courting unions. That's, of course, Sanders' territory. He
right.
does this all the time. And on my tour, I was in a union hall in Indianapolis. And this is, you know, one of the carrier local. This is the famous one that Trump was used as his example all the time. And it was sort of the key to Trump's appeal to the white working class. And well, beyond that, I mean, he did pretty well with the black working class, too, in the sense that a lot of them didn't bother to vote.
Right.
You know, didn't get motivated for Hillary. I was in their union hall, and there's pictures of Bernie Sanders all over the place. This is and also they I mean by the way a lot of like cartoons making fun of Donald Trump, okay? So this is really interesting. They love Bernie Sanders. You know, these people really 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 like this guy. He was their ideal candidate. Anyhow, so of course the Democratic Party wants to, you know, understands that they've got to reach out to those voters. But at the same time, I mean, I'm here in Washington D.C. All you hear from Democrats about working class voters is just scolding and contempt, you know.
And so, where does this go? I mean, tell me about your skepticism aside from what you're hearing, obviously, in Washington. Would it be different if Bernie Sanders was, I don't know, 25 years younger?
Oh, of course. Oh my goodness, yes, of course. But there has to be another Bernie. That's the thing, and I don't, you know. Bernie was such an unlikely story, the way he got going, and you know, and he did so phenomenally well against the Clinton machine, you know, much better than anybody thought he would.
I think much better than he thought he would, frankly, significantly
yeah.
better
yeah.
than he thought he would.
By the way, so you could say the same thing about Donald Trump.
Well, that's true. That's true. Although I'm,
he had no idea he was going to win.
Now, let me ask you this. Why do you think it is the case? I mean, obviously, Bernie Sanders is not a Democrat, technically a Democrat. He doesn't register as a Democrat, but obviously he's caucused with the Democrats his entire career. And, in the context of a two-party system, that he's not a Democrat is rather cosmetic. But why is it the case that really when you look at why is it that we only have the Bernie Sanders that we have on a public, never on a national scale, even a regional scale, is a guy in his 70s. I mean, Jerry Brown, I don't think he's nearly as well. I mean, in some respects, he's, I think, as to the left as Bernie. But at the very least, he's leaning into things a lot more, I think, than the
yeah.
I mean, why?
Yeah, but I doubt he's going to be running for president.
Well, that's my point. They're both, guys who are up in age. I'm not convinced that Bernie Sanders is not going to run. I mean, I think that he is going to run. I think he's certainly contemplating it. I mean, I imagine if he found somebody along the way that he, I think he was largely waiting for Elizabeth Warren to run, and when he realized that she wasn't
going
to.
That's what I've heard as well, but, what do I know? But Elizabeth Warren is that's the name, that's the person, that's the one who should have been in this last race, and hopefully we'll try next time around. That's my own personal hope. But there's other Democrats who fit that profile, and they too can just come out of nowhere in the way that Bernie did. I mean, Bernie was the most unlikely presidential candidate.
Well, who else do you perceive that might be those Democrats?
Oh. I think Sherrod Brown, certainly, from Ohio, the senator from Ohio, certainly fits that profile. I think Al Franken is looking really good these days, the senator from Minnesota. I used to watch him on Saturday Night Live when I was a kid, though. I still can't get over the fact that he's a politician now, you know. But there's lots of good Democrats out there. They just don't happen to be in the driver's seat of the party.
Do you think there's been a broader acceptance of sort of the surely you must feel like there's some vindication in terms of going back to what's the matter with Kansas, right? I mean, does this last race?
Yeah, but it's a horrible vindication. Yes, of course. But and look and listen, liberal is like everything in there turned. I mean, it's just so it's so awful. It's all true. And Trump used it. I mean, I don't know if he read the book. I doubt it. But he was saying he was using the kind of he was attacking these people in exactly the way the weaknesses that I described. I'm not, I'm happy in the sense that now people are listening and people are buying the book and that sort of thing. But it's not. I don't get invited to Democratic Party postmortems. I'm not on TV. Nothing has changed. I'm still here on I'm still here with you, Sam.
Well, and
but I'm not like part of the DC apparatus. Look, I don't even write for an American publication. I mean, that's how bad it is. I'm here in DC. The world of American thought and journalism is shrinking and shrinking and shrinking all the time. And there's no publication in this country that'll have me. So, vindicated, but so what?
Right. Well, let's just turn a little bit to what you wrote in the Baffler about
That's right. That is the one American publication, the one I founded.
That's I'm sitting on the show. I'm sitting on a show that I'm connecting the camera and the microphone. Yeah. So I appreciate that. But I mean, you wrote a piece about this curatolatry. Is that how I pronounce it?
Curatolatry. Uh-huh.
And this idea of, I mean, again, I guess it's sort of
it's a buzzword. So a lot of my best stories start with cliches and buzzwords, things that are out there in the language and are getting abused. And the word is curator. everybody wants to think of themselves as a curator these days. It's really curious. And you start noticing it all over the place, like people using it in casual conversation and stuff. And it's, restaurants call themselves this. There's a brand of soda pop called Curator or Curate or something like that. It comes, of course, from art galleries. It goes back further than that. It's like these were museum officials. They used to be educational officials. A curator was an official in the, the Church of England or something like that. But it's a kind of vaguely defined professional who is in charge of determining what is good and what is bad, what should be included in the canon and what should be excluded. And we're in love with this idea of the person who chooses those things. And the big metaphor, the people who abuse this metaphor the most is, the internet world. So Facebook used to have people whose jobs was to be news curators. They got fired eventually. They got replaced with an algorithm, which is what's going to happen to all of us eventually. But this is the idea that everybody is, this is the sexy idea that everybody is in love with. Everybody wants to describe themselves and their web page as curators of this and that. The first half or so of the essay just takes note of all of the hilarious ways in which this word is used and abused.
And then we move into the idea of like the implications of it. I mean,
why is that? Yeah.
I mean,
and the political side of it, which is really, really weird, that it is used by liberals and not by conservatives. And liberals think of themselves as curators. They think of other liberals like Barack Obama as, curating this and curating that. That just seems like something Barack Obama would do, right? He would curate things. And whereas Donald Trump is always identified with a refusal of curation, that he doesn't understand how to curate. I mean, it's just how journalists, they're just using the language. And when they are describing Trump, they'll often say, he doesn't know how to curate this. That's beyond his abilities. Or people who describe themselves as curators will be involved in some kind of resistance against Donald Trump, some kind of denunciation of Donald Trump. It's really funny. I mean, this is not something you would ever think of, and yet it's the case. The word is almost exclusively identified with liberalism. In the case of Facebook, I was talking about their news curators. When they did away with that job last summer, I guess it was, that's when the whole fake news epidemic first came into the public eye. They did away with the news curators, and instantly we were deluged, deluged with fake news. All of these crazy fake news stories that were making their way through Facebook, because now there was no longer any curator to protect us from
fake isn't news. This, isn't it a function of the fact that there's so much information out there, right? I mean, we have a couple of different phenomena that's going on. One is we have a total breakdown of people's trust in institutions. And at the same time, we have so much information that is coming at us in the form of media, and even we advertise for like clothes curators, right? Like they'll send you what clothes
they'll curate
you
your wardrobe for you,
exactly. But that the liberal mind, broadly speaking, is actually far more open to all this information, whereas the conservative mind is specifically not. And
is that what it is? I don't know about
that.
So there's two takes that I have on this that I think are worth mentioning. And the first of all is what I think is very typical of modern liberalism is its love affair with professionals and with professionalism, and the idea that they're very comfortable with the idea of making these choices for people. Very comfortable with that, with some authority figure telling you what's right and what's wrong, curating this, selecting this and excluding that, which, by the way, is an operation that I have been an editor. Obviously, I edited Baffler magazine for a long time, and that was roughly speaking, that's what I did. But it's still, it's an operation that people regard, I think Americans regard with a certain amount of suspicion. Because it's authority, it's life's officer corps. You are the general, and I am the private, and you choose what I get to see because you know what's good for me. And a lot of people, especially conservatives, regard this with suspicion, and liberals are very comfortable with the idea. The second part of it that's fascinating to me is that when I was younger, it was the what we now call the sort of creators of content that we admired, novelists, authors,
right,
you know, journalists, people who wrote things, people who painted things, people who wrote poetry. I don't know, you go down the list of cultural creators. And that's who we admired, and that's who we looked up to, and that's who we wanted to be. And now it's different. We don't admire those people, or we do, but their role is much diminished. They are, as I said before, content creators. You know, they just create content. That stuff is just content. What I do is I make content. I type words. We all know it's the curator that matters. It's the guy that, you know, it's the guy behind the control panel at the TV station or at the radio. You know, the guy who gets to choose what songs to play on the radio, the editor who chooses what to accept and what to dismiss. And we not only accept that, we admire it. And, you know, what the thing that bothers me about it is because if you ask me, we're in an age, I think, where the curators have run amok. You know, we were talking earlier about Washington, D.C. and the opinion climate in Washington, D.C. And when I look at the state of American journalism now, you know, I don't see a beautiful art gallery where, you know, you've got these wonderful things paired with each other and, you know, and fine wine and all this crap. What I see is a cartel. I see the operation of, you know, a small clique of people who all know each other and who all get, you know, their funding from the same handful of foundations and who pretty much control what we talk about here in this town. I'll give you an example. How many times have you heard now the results of the last election blamed on the Russians?
Just once or twice.
No, it is universal.
Right.
It is to the exclusion of everything else. And the fact is, as you and I know, Sam, elections are complicated, messy things, and you can understand them in the details, and you can understand them in the grand scope of things. And if you know, the election of 2016 was a really big deal. This was an enormous, plate shifting, tectonic election, and to brush it off as a result of essentially, you know, a shoplifting operation, you know, an electronic shoplifting operation, is close to crazy.
Well, I mean,
and that's what's happening.
All right, let me,
because of the curators.
Let me push back on a couple of ideas that and I know we don't have too much time here, but I mean, aside from, like, I happen to agree with you that there's a lot of but-fors that need to be examined in terms of this election. And, you know, and when you have a swing of 35,000 votes over the course of three states, they're all going to be in play. And I can understand why some find it far more sexy to see it as sabotage. Rather than like, hey, they used modeling instead of going out in the field to see if they were hitting on the right doors.
Yeah, I mean, among other things. But you're talking about the all of these things are tactical. These are small things, and they're all totally true. I'm not saying sabotage or that the Russian thing didn't happen.
Right.
Of course it did. So did the FBI thing. That happened.
Right.
That was huge.
Right.
But if you're as long as you're, this is something I learned in high school debate. If you're going to let one side say, okay, well, we didn't make that fumble, you know, take that fumble away and we would have won, you have to let the other side say that too. So Trump can easily say, all right, well, then the groping tape never appeared. You know,
right.
Trump never made fun of handicapped people. You know, Trump never made the remark about Mexicans. You know, if you can allow one side to excuse, you see what I'm getting at here?
Yeah.
As long as you're playing counterfactual.
Right.
But the other thing, the real way that we need to be thinking about this is in the grand, you know, the grand historical sweep of things.
Right. It shouldn't have been. In other words, it shouldn't have been that close.
No one has any. The Democrats have no interest in doing that.
Right.
All of their interest is in suppressing that kind of speculation, that kind of inquiry. They do not want to do that. And that's an act of curation.
And do you think, though, is it worse now than it's been in the past? I mean, I think, you know, to me, I think the era of curation is less about I'm a general and you're a private, but that because you as a private now, you actually have an option to find different generals. And maybe that's just because I spend more time online than in anywhere else anymore. But
You and me both. But listen, that's the irony of it. And that's what fascinates me. You know, we talked earlier, but I've spent my whole life writing about populism. And that's true. But the other big subject of my entire journalistic career has been that we supposedly live in this age of incredible, democracy, you know, the internet, of course. And at the same time, the curators have never been more powerful. I think they are more powerful today than in the past for a lot of different reasons. I mean, and I'll give you just a handful of examples, and that is the internet is supposed to be this thing that's democratizing and allowing everyone a voice and all that sort of thing, but it has also permitted monopolies on a scale that unimagined by, you know, the John D. Rockefellers of the past. And that's true in culture as well, that you both have, you know, we're all able to type an essay now and print it out and make it look really beautiful. We're all able to set up a blog if we want to. But at the same time, the voices, you know, there's only three newspapers in this country that matter anymore.
Right.
And, you know, you can exclude the Wall Street Journal because they're an outlier. So you're down to two. My old, I also used to write for them. So you're down to two. And all the rest of the media in this country takes their sort of marching orders from those two newspapers, the Washington Post and the New York Times. That's creepy. This is a country of 300 million people. And, you know, when I go to foreign countries like Australia, a land of about 20 million people, or any of the Scandinavian countries, which are just a little bit bigger than that, I find much more openness to ideas like mine than I find in this country. And this country is, you know, vast. Anyhow. That's my complaint for the day, Sam.
Well,
thanks for hearing me out, buddy.
No, I appreciate it. In fact, we're going to do an interview next week about sort of some of that monopoly power that, you know, particularly we see in like Facebook and YouTube and
yeah.
Google.
Yeah, I wasn't going to name any names, but yeah, that's exactly. It's weird, isn't it?
I mean, I think on some level. I'm so immersed in that world that it's sometimes hard to see like the alternative. I mean, I think to a large extent, there's a lot of that is, you know, where,
it is hard
adapted
to see the alternative
because we've adapted too well.
We're in a new world here.
Yeah.
We're in a new world here, but I think monopolies act the same as they always have. And I think this is one of the great, by the way, we're getting off track here, but this is one of the great missed opportunities of the Obama era was to try to figure out a way through this. You know, hold those hearings, do those investigations, you know, and try to develop antitrust policy for the 21st century. Instead, they just let it go.
I'll tell you something. I think it was also one of the lost opportunities of a Clinton era, frankly, and not necessarily from the Clinton people. But I can tell you that in the last year running up to the election, that there was so much energy just building and getting ready to deal with antitrust. That was what Elizabeth Warren was going to be the primary focus of what she was going to be doing, was going to be antitrust. There's still vestiges of it and there's still people talking about it, but obviously doesn't have the same opportunities.
Oh yeah, but how far could you expect Clinton to go when Eric Schmidt is standing at her right hand, you know, the CEO of Google? You know, these people are really...
Well, you could see Amazon broken up. You could see
Facebook
broken up, just not Google.
I'm sorry, that would be awesome. That would be awesome, but that was Trump was promising to do that.
Right, right.
Do you remember?
Well, yes, and of course, you know, but Trump was...
And remember Trump also promised a new Glass-Steagall Act?
Looks like it's unlikely at this stage. We'd have to check with Gary Cohn.
There's such cynicism, you know, to say things like that in such a cynical way.
Well, yeah. There's,
oh, well.
There's a,
yeah, welcome, oh, to, well. Welcome to Washington.
All right. Well, Thomas, we'll check in with you in a couple of months and see if you're still in such a cheery mood.
Oh, Sam, I'm sorry. Every time I talk to you, I get that way. I'm sorry. I need to get out of it and I need to snap out of it. You're exactly right. I need to put a smile on my face and a song in my heart.
Well, we'll see. We'll see what happens. Maybe, you know, 2018 will work in the right way. And I guess I don't know. It should be interesting to see where this this interesting battle ends up in the with the Democrats. But Thomas Frank, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Anytime you want, man. I'm at your service.
Okay, we'll talk to you soon.
Bye.
The only person that guy likes more than you is Bill O'Reilly.
That's right. Yeah. Thomas Frank, the top 10 guys, Bill O'Reilly, Sam Cedar. That's Bill O'Reilly. Basically the works.
Sam Cedar! We're on top of the Thomas Frank list together. Did I tell you the story about how, I mean, it's not even much of a story, but about a week after the election, I was in Chelsea. And I was meeting
in Manhattan. Chelsea,
Mass? Oh, no, okay. In Manhattan. And I was meeting somebody, and all of a sudden I noticed this tall, sort of poorly postured gentleman walking in my direction. And I realized that's Eric Schmidt.
Oh.
And I texted Matt, actually, because I literally needed to break.
Eric Schmidt could be sitting right where you are.
You
and
don't
I
know what he looks
no
like.
No idea what
he looks like. Probably what you would imagine he looks like. He looks like a tech guy.
Like a Google.
He looks like a Google. If I had to describe him in a word, I would say a Google, exactly. But I really had this moment of like, you effing cuck. You got beat by Breitbart. Yeah. Like, with all of the money, all of the arrogance, all of the engineers, everything you had, you couldn't even beat a friggin' orange-faced predator.
Yeah.
SOB.
Didn't they have that like secret?
Well, that's what I was thinking of. They had that secret.
The groundwork. It was called.
It was called the groundwork, and they had the Latin word and the. It was designed. It was almost like.
The website was designed to
freak out. Like, this is a. And we had on a guest, some, you know, very interesting professor. I'm like, well, this, you know, this might help Hillary, but this has a future potential effect on algorithms and the news you get on Google. And it was like, this is something we really got to think about as we gear up for the next, you know, neoliberal administration. And then all of a sudden it was like, there you go.
It launched after the election, and it's like a weak, our revolution type
of
thing.
Yeah, I was like, no thanks. Yeah, I don't know.
But when Build we first movement, went to it yeah. during the election,
no,
it was
much
very
more
cryptic.
It was something different.
It was like all
it was all
like
black.
Black page, yes. And it was very cryptic and nothing link, you know, clickable, and it was just
it was this image.
Yeah, like what?
Yeah. And then Trump just came along.
I was actually freaking out about that, cuz at that point it was like Hillary's going to win and like the Silicon Valley is just going to take over.
Right. And
they couldn't even
do that. It was just like, actually, we have this website where we drink and we make up stories about Mexican people. I think we're going to beat Google.
Yeah, I think so too, Steve. Yeah. Apparently, they've got all these algorithms and everything, but I have another idea. How about we just go to do a big rally and we say, we don't want Muslims in the country? I think that might work.
Yeah. People don't like brown people. I mean, that's
the thing is, like, they have thousands of people working on this, and it's so intellectual. But how about this? Mexican smell. How about that?
And you know, there's been a lot of data that has come out in, like, I think in the past week from the, in particular, it is the American National Election Study, the 2016. And this is... this study has been conducted since 1948. They do in-person surveys, online surveys, with 1,200 nationally representative respondents answering questions for about 80 minutes. They match it up with, I think, with voter files and whatnot. I'm not sure if how comprehensive in that regard. But this is a study that is, you know, sort of one of the benchmark studies. And different people have different takes on it, but it's quite clear that racism played a big role. It's also quite clear that Trump got an atypical distribution
in terms of income for a Republican. And it's almost like inverted. Wealthy people did not vote in the same way that they usually do for Republicans.
Right.
People living in poverty did not vote in the same numbers that they did for Democrats.
Well, we talked about it in real time. It was like, how appealing is that message to go to people who, on one hand, have always been voting out of racism and bigotry, just with subtext, which we've said a million times. And then on the other hand, someone comes along and says, look, if you're any type of below a couple hundred thousand dollar a year person, it's clear that this stuff doesn't work. You know, that's an appealing primary message.
Yeah.
It's obvious.
I mean, here is the thing, too, is that like there's two parts to this pitch, right? One is like your situation sucks. Okay. Which Donald Trump was one of the few people, in the general election, you know, Hillary Clinton saying, you know, America is great. And he's saying, your situation sucks. And then he's also saying, and the way you fix it is to basically take it out on people who are not like you. Yeah.
Where have we seen that before?
Right. Yes, indeed.
A lot of really successful things.
But the thing is that it's very hard to, for whatever reason, for people to wrap their minds around the idea that you can take the first part of that equation and change the second part of that equation. And in some respects, and I think you played this clip. I heard this clip that you played yesterday with Tom Perez about, you know, will Tom Perez name an enemy? And this is a problem, frankly, that I had with, what's his face? He turned presidential.
Fareed?
No, the other guy after the speech.
Oh, Van Jones?
Yeah. Van Jones launched something that was supposedly the anti-Tea Party thing about 4 or 5 years ago. And I did an interview on this program with him. And I remember during the course of the interview being extremely frustrated that I was like, well, who's the enemy? And he would not name anybody. He would not name the billionaires even, or the 1%. He would not name those people. And I think the sincerity of the first part of that pitch is undercut by not providing a second part. And with Donald Trump, people believed him not just because he said, like, you're hurting, but he said, like, and I've got a solution for you. And it was one which they were very comfortable with.
Yes.
And even if it's one that doesn't fit quite as, and I think that's what activated a lot of that racism, was like, oh, man, this is not just like, I don't like black people. This is like, I don't like black people or brown people, and I got a legitimate reason.
This actually means something, man.
Right? Like,
I've been around here for a long time hating him, but wait a second.
Wait a second.
This kind of fits
apparently
into something.
Apparently, it was rational.
Apparently, I used to kind of feel a little awkward about my hatred of these people, but now, hey, man, they hurt my earnings.
Exactly.
What I told you about the Reagan Democrat polls that they did back in the early 90s or the 80s at Stan Greenberg, and they found that basically they didn't trust Reagan or Republicans on corporations, but they felt that no one was really going to restrain corporations. But what Republicans would do is punish black people.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, so I think like you can have Donald Trump elected because of racism, but undercut that dynamic by not necessarily addressing racism directly, which is not to say that you shouldn't. But in terms of undercutting that particular equation, I think there's other ways of undercutting it. And, you know, it's interesting, though, the tremendous amount of sort of the re-explosion of this fight between the Bernie-crats and Hillary-ites. And I think it's probably more contained. It gets in, you know, it gets magnified by the fact that I spend all day on Twitter, and this is sort of the central nexus of this, you know. There is definitely a distinction between, like, you know, a John Ossoff candidacy and Thompson in Kansas, and or a Quist in Montana, or, you know, it would have been interesting to see what happens if you have like another Kathy Hochul race in upstate New York that we had, I don't know, I guess it was a decade ago now. All right, we got to take a break, head into the fun half of the program, folks. And oh, it's going to be so fun. We're going to have a lot of clips talking about what a wretched, horrible human being Bill O'Reilly is.
Merlin Factor! I'm not on TV as much anymore. I got more time to talk up women.
We've got an amazing post that was on Facebook from a guy who, this is apparently extremely legit. This guy, a lot of people that I know this guy personally and have vouched for the veracity of this. But Ivanka Trump does not come off very good in this this exchange.
It's shocking.
And I will also very excitedly talk about how some patriots didn't show up to Donald Trump's party.
Sorry, dude. You're just too toxic. And my wife also said she won't have sex with me anymore. So not going to be there.
Totally on board with that. If that's what created, let's listen. At the
Liz
very
Estrella,
least,
man.
I can say to my daughter, Tom Brady did not show up at the White House. And honestly, like, to be able to say that is...
How much better does that make your week?
I mean, you know, it's not huge, but it's pretty big.
Well, it actually...
Because at my house, honestly, like, all my Patriots stuff have, like, the tape through it. Because I don't want to get rid of the hat. And when I wear it out, though, it has... I have, like, some duct tape through it. And It's basically for the sake of my daughter.
I like it's the like more you I hear and like about a homeless guy at
that
Penn
I don't
Station.
See, the more it sounds great.
This is the high end of my wardrobe I wear into the office.
I think it's what's so funny, though, is it's awesome because Brady praised him, it's so much more hurtful.
Yes.
Like, it's great. It ends up actually being a big payoff.
It feels like
a
never loss. Flirted.
Yes. Yeah. Like if Brady from the beginning was like, I don't talk about politics or whatever, and Trump didn't feel like, me and Tom. But right. Because he felt like me and Tom, and now it's
Wait,
not me and Tom.
You're going to flirt with
I'm
me and
toxic now that I am president?
That doesn't make any
Wait
sense.
Wait a second.
Hold on.
I won.
Tom, I'll bomb Korea. I what won. Do I need to do? I'll feed Mike Pence to dogs. Anything.
Did you see that? All right, we'll talk about it, but that quote of Mike Pence saying, like, the sword is... Did you see that quote?
No, I didn't. Let's find it.
I don't know if he said it.
I'm feeling my roots a little bit. I was just in Korea, and I was swinging my dick a little bit.
The sword stands ready.
Exactly.
Mike Pence said in South Korea.
You sure that wasn't from O'Reilly transcripts?
You know what, guys?
Say, baby, put down that pipe and get my pipe.
Guys,
up.
I don't think I want to bomb Korea anymore. Mike really ruined it with that line. It's weird. Let's just work on some patents instead. All right.
646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. Folks, it's your membership that makes this show possible. And if you have the financial means to do so, please do. We are now, our YouTube stuff, we're in the midst of this big YouTube apocalypse or whatever they call it. And our YouTube is now...
Apocalypse
is now a little bit of a drag on the show. So if you have the means to become a member, please do so at jointhemajorityreport.com. Don't forget justcoffee.coop, MRSpring17. Use the coupon code 30% off just this month only. Free shipping as well. And if you buy crap from Amazon, go to our link at majorityreportkickback.com, majorityreportkickback.com. Click on the Amazon link. And buy your stuff through that always, and we get a kickback. See you in the fun half.